Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 26, which I will entitle, You Keep Him in Perfect Peace. This is a chapter like the last chapter, which is very positive. There's a little bit of judgment in there too, but it's judgment on the bad guys. And there's a lot of hope and salvation in this chapter. We start now in verses 1 through 6. Isaiah says this, In that day this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. God makes salvation its walls and ramparts. Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter, the nation that keeps faith. You will keep in perfect peace him whose mind is steadfast, because he trusts in you. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord is the rock eternal. He humbles those who dwell on high. He lays the lofty city low. He levels it to the ground and casts it down to the dust. Feet trample it down, the feet of the oppressed, the footsteps of the poor. Now, as usual, we need to try to determine at what time Isaiah was prophesying. Not when he was making the prophecy, but when it was fulfilled. In verse 1, it says, In that day this song will be sung. Well, here's some options. Option number 1, this is from Barnes and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown. This is referring to the day when Judah returns from the Babylonian exile. The time that they do that. And Barnes also says there are some indications that this was designed to be sung with a chorus and with alternate responses, as many of the psalms were, because Isaiah says, in that day this song will be sung. So this makes it look like Isaiah is referring to something that's going to happen physically for Judah. But there is another option how we can take this. This day could be the day of the Messiah, the days of Jesus. John Gill, Joseph Benson, Ellicott, and Poole all hold to that view. And also Adam Clark is what Adam Clark says. This chapter, like the foregoing, is a song of praise in which thanksgivings for temporal and spiritual mercies are beautifully mingled, though the latter still predominate. Spiritual mercies predominate over temporal mercies, Clark is saying. Even the sublime and evangelical doctrine of the resurrection seems here to be hinted at, and made to typify the deliverance of the people of God from a state of the lowest misery. We'll talk about this resurrection when we get to the end of the chapter. The captivity, the general dispersion, or both. This hymn, too, like the preceding, is beautifully diversified by the frequent change of speakers. Well, basically, Clark is saying that you can fulfill it physically with the return of the exiles from Babylon, or you can say it's going to be fulfilled spiritually with the rise of the church. Clark continues, The song opens with a chorus of the church, celebrating the protection vouchsafed by God to his people and the happiness of the righteous, whom he guards, contrasted with the misery of the wicked, whom he punishes. So many people take this to be a messianic prophecy. Now, of course, you can take it as being fulfilled with the Babylonians, and that's a type of what's going to happen with the church, and that's the way I prefer to take it. The pulpit commentator actually says Isaiah is prophesying about the final state. I think that's probably off the wall a little bit. Now, in verse 1, Isaiah says, In that day this song will be sung in the land of Judah. That makes it sound like Babylon, the return from Babylon, the land of Judah. However, that could be taken figuratively, as Matthew Poole says, in the church of God, which in Scripture is oft signified by the titles of Judah and Jerusalem and Zion or the like. And that's true. Zion oftentimes is used as a symbol for the New Testament Church of God, even though it physically was a hill in Jerusalem. So just to keep this exposition of this chapter simple for me, I'm going to say that Isaiah is prophesying about the physical return from Babylon, and that's a type of the rise of the church. At the end of verse 1, Isaiah says, We have a strong city. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that's a type of the New Jerusalem, which is the church. Now note that if that be so, and I believe it probably is, note that the church is strong. It's a strong city. The church is strong. God makes salvation its walls and ramparts. You're in the church, you're going to get saved. John Gill makes the point here that the language is moving from the physical, the city, the walls, and the ramparts. The language moves from the physical to the spiritual, because in verse 2, we see the righteous nation, the nation that keeps faith, righteousness, faithfulness, peace, trust. Now in verse 2, the Israelites singing the song say, Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter. Of course, those gates can be the physical Jerusalem gates, or it could be the gates of the New Jerusalem, the church, or again, the gates could be a type of the church, open the gates of the church, that the righteous nation may enter, that the church may enter the New Jerusalem. Peter uses the expression righteous nation or holy nation, referring to the church. In 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, which is the same thing as a righteous nation. And the you he's talking to is the church. In fact, he might have been quoting from Isaiah here, or at least alluding to Isaiah. In verse 3, Isaiah says, you will keep in perfect peace him whose mind is steadfast because he trusts in you. Application of that is obvious. Trust in God, you'll stay peaceful. Verse 4, trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord is the rock eternal. That's three Yahwehs right there. One of them might be Yah, the short term of it. But basically three Yahwehs right there in one verse, one half a verse. The Lord is the rock eternal. Our God is a rock. Sounds like a psalm. I don't have a quote there, but God is often referred to as a rock in the Psalms. A rock is something that doesn't move. It provides shelter in a cave at the top of a rocky crag. Protection. Verse 5, God humbles those who dwell on high. He lays the lofty city low. The lofty city there, according to Barnes, is referring to Babylon. And Babylon, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, represents all the foes of God's people in all ages. We see some generic references to this in the previous chapter, Isaiah 25:2. For you have turned the city into a pile of rocks, a fortified city into ruins. The fortress of barbarians is no longer a city. It will never be rebuilt. Isaiah 25:12, the high-walled fortress will be brought down, thrown to the ground, to the dust. And so the city stands for those who have raised up themselves in opposition to God on high. That's why the city is called lofty. It was lofty, but it's laid low. God levels it to the ground, casts it down to the dust. In verse 6, feet trample it down, the feet of the oppressed, the footsteps of the poor. Now, John Gill refers that to the church. He refers every possible type to the church, but it could be feet trampled down Babylon. Whose feet? The feet of the oppressed Israelites, those who have been oppressed by Babylon. We move now to Isaiah 26:7 through 11. Isaiah continues, the path of the righteous is level, O upright one. You make the way of the righteous smooth. Yes, Lord, walking in the way of your laws, we wait for you. Your name and renown are the desire of our hearts. My soul yearns for you in the night. In the morning my spirit longs for you. When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. Though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. Even in a land of uprightness, they go on doing evil and regard not the majesty of the Lord. O Lord, your hand is lifted high, but they do not see it. Let them see your zeal for your people and be put to shame. Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them. Well, here's a little bit of judgment on the nations of the world who oppose Israel. In verse 9, Isaiah says, when your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness. Some people have said that refers to unbelievers becoming saved. The problem with that, in the very next verse, verse 10, they don't learn righteousness. Though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. So here's the basic problem. In verse 9, the people of the world learn righteousness. In verse 10, the wicked do not learn righteousness. Well, there's two ways you can reconcile that. The first way is, you say in verse 9, the world at large learns what righteousness is when they see God's judgment in verse 9. But then in verse 10, the individual wicked person does not learn righteousness because he doesn't pay attention to God's judgments. If we use a different translation, we might see that a little better. Isaiah 26:9 through 10 in the New American Bible says this, my soul yearns for you in the night. Yes, my spirit within me keeps vigil for you. When your judgment dawns upon the earth, the world's inhabitants learn justice. So the world's inhabitants, that's plural, they learn justice. And then in verse 10, the wicked man, singular, spared from that judgment, does not learn justice. In an upright land, he acts perversely. So the idea is general judgment in verse 9, but individual wicked people don't pay attention to that judgment in verse 10. And that would reconcile it. But probably a better way to reconcile it is the people are different. In verse 9, the people of the world are believers who learn righteousness, but in verse 10, grace is shown to the wicked, a different group of people, and they don't learn righteousness. Even in a land of uprightness, they, the wicked, go on doing evil and regard not the majesty of the Lord. The land of uprightness, That's probably not any particular place. It could be a general reference to any righteous land. Of course, it could be referring to Israel. In verse 11, Isaiah says, O Lord, your hand is lifted high. Why? His hand is lifted high because it's about to come down hard on God's enemies. But they do not see it. The wicked don't see it. And that's typical of people who are out there sinning like crazy, murdering, raping, lying, stealing, cheating. There's no excuse for them not seeing it. They're suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. They should know they're made in the image of God. All they got to do is look at the stars and know that there's a God out there. All they got to do is look at their consciences and know that there's right and wrong. No, they don't see God's judgment coming. Isaiah finishes verse 11 by saying, Let them see your zeal for your people and be put to shame. And remember, God's people now in the New Testament are the church. And that's what we should pray, that God would show his zeal for the people of God, the church, so that the world will see it and that they will be put to shame. Let the fire reserved for your enemies consume them. Let the enemies of the church be consumed, not literally by fire, but destroyed, so that the church will be established. We go now to Isaiah chapter 26, verses 12 through 15. Isaiah says this, Lord, you established peace for us. All that we have accomplished, you have done for us. O Lord our God, other lords besides you have ruled over us, but your name alone do we honor. They are now dead. They live no more. Those departed spirits do not rise. You punished them and brought them to ruin. You wiped out all memory of them. You have enlarged the nation, O Lord. You have enlarged the nation. You have gained glory for yourself. You have extended all the borders of the land. In verse 12, Isaiah says God has established peace for the Israelites, and I'm assuming that's because they were set free from Babylon, returned to the land of Israel. Of course, this is prophecy, not history. Isaiah prophesied in the 8th century the return to Israel was in 538 or so, a couple of centuries later. In verse 13, God is addressed by the Israelites who say that other lords besides God have ruled over the Israelites. What other lords? Well, some people take that spiritually and say sin and Satan was a lord over the Israelites. Somebody and some commentator said Balaam, the Baals. The Cambridge commentary doesn't like that type of interpretation. They say, quote, that the reference is to foreign despotisms and not, as some have thought, to false gods, may be regarded as certain. Well, I agree with them there. It's talking about some kind of people lords. Could be Jewish governors over Israel who didn't know the Lord. There were plenty of those, plenty of kings. Could be the Assyrians, as Poole and Benson suggest. It could be the Philistines in the earlier history of Israel, which Poole and Benson suggest. It could be the Babylonians, which Barnes and Benson suggest, and that's who I think it is. Now, there is a problem. Isaiah puts all of this in the past tense. It sounds like he's writing history. But remember, Isaiah wrote before the Babylonians. But remember, Isaiah is a prophet, and prophets prophesy. Sometimes they do foretell the future. In verse 15, Isaiah says that Yahweh has enlarged the nation. What nation? Here's three options. First, the physical nation of Israel. Barnes holds to that. He says, quote, the nation was not only enlarged by its regular increase of population, but many converts attended them on their return from Babylon, and probably many came in from surrounding nations on the rebuilding of their capital. So there's a nice literal physical interpretation. John Gill, as usual, says, no, it's the church. You have enlarged the nation, the royal nation, the holy priesthood, the church. The pulpit commentator says it's the physical nation of Israel as a type of the church. That's the view that I favor. We go now to Isaiah 26, verses 16 through 18. Isaiah continues, Lord, they came to you in their distress. When you disciplined them, they could barely whisper a prayer. The they there is referring to the Israelites or the Judahites. Verse 17, as a woman with child and about to give birth writhes and cries out in her pain, so were we in your presence, O Lord. We were with child. We writhed in pain, but we gave birth to wind. We have not brought salvation to the earth. We have not given birth to people of the world. Now in verse 16, Isaiah refers to a distress of God's people. Lord, they came to you in their distress when you disciplined them. Who were the they? What distress is Isaiah talking about? Here's some options. John Gill says it's the so-called capital G, capital T, Great Tribulation, which is ironic because Gill is no dispensationalist. He probably referred the Great Tribulation to what it was, in my humble orthodox opinion, the tribulation of the church right before the Romans took down the persecuting Jews in AD 70. And so if that's true, then the reference would be to the church being persecuted by the Jews. He could just refer to all the times Israel was in trouble. In other words, a general reference. Or it could be when the Babylonians captured them, and I think that's what it's talking about. When you discipline them, they could barely whisper a prayer. That's exactly their situation when all of Jerusalem was burnt down and the whole nation of Judah was smashed by the Babylonians. And then we have the common reference to a woman in labor. They must have had some horribly painful births back in the time of Israel, because the imagery of a woman screaming in labor is used a lot. They apparently had not learned of the Lamaze method where that's not necessary. As a woman with child and about to give birth writhes and cries out in her pain, that's how the Israelites were. In verse 18, Isaiah says the Israelites were with child, writhing in pain, but they gave birth to wind. Instead of a nice bouncing little baby boy or girl, they gave birth to wind, which is nothing, because wind slips right through your fingers and it's gone. Now we need to look at two alternate translations of verse 18. The last part of verse 18 could be translated something like this: the inhabitants of the world have not fallen. Or it could be translated like the NIV, which I just read: we have not given birth. So, inhabitants of the world not fallen, or inhabitants of the world or the earth or the land not having given birth. Well, let's take the first possibility: inhabitants of the world have not fallen. We can see the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it that way. We became pregnant. We writhed in pain. We gave birth to wind. We have won no victories on earth, and the earth's inhabitants have not fallen. In other words, Israel has been beaten by the Babylonians. The ASV says, we have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. In other words, we haven't beaten the bad guys. Darby says, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. We haven't beaten the bad guys. Young's literal translation says, nor do the inhabitants of the world fall. Same thing. That's the simplest way to take it. Now, there are other translations who take it the way the NIV does. We have not given birth to people. Inhabitants of the world have not been born. Jameson Fawcett Brown explains why it should be translated that way. He quotes another commentator named Mara. Mara explains fallen according to Arabic idiom of the birth of a child, which is said to fall when being born. So, inhabitants of the world are not yet born. That is, the country as yet lies desolate as and is not yet populated. Now, we have some translations that go that way. The NIV that I read, the Bible in Basic English, says we have been with child, we have been in pain, we have given birth to wind. No salvation has come to the earth through us, and no children have come into the world. Isaiah 26:18, we were pregnant. This is in God's Word translation. We were pregnant. We writhed with labor pains only to give birth to the wind. We weren't able to bring salvation to the land, and no new people were born on earth. Notice they translate earth as land in the first part. Well, let's look at two optional meanings which depend on the translation. If we assume the fall translation, the inhabitants of the world do not fall, then, as Barnes says, Judah had no power to subdue the Babylonians. That's the easiest way to take it. But here's another way to take it from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. This is the birth translation. The people of the world have not given birth. This means that Judah lies desolate and is not populated. Now, to get that meaning, you have to make some assumptions. First, as I said, that it's birth. The fall means birth, like the Arabs used to say, the baby fell, the baby was born. So we translate it as birth. That's the first assumption you have to make. The second assumption is that earth should be translated land, as the NAB does. So we would read, we have not brought salvation to the land, we have not given birth. And the third assumption you have to make is that the world means Judah. We have not brought salvation to the land. We have not given birth to people of Judah. In other words, we haven't repopulated the land yet. Now, how can we say that the world means Judah? It sounds like the whole world, not just Judah or not just Israel. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says point blank, it means Israel, not the world in general. Jameson Fawcett and Brown quote Isaiah 24:4 in order to back themselves up there. And Isaiah 24:4 says in the Young's literal translation, mourned, fadeth, hath the land. Languished, faded, hath the world. Languished have they, the high place of the people of the land. So Young's literal takes earth as land. that's Haaretz, land, and right in the middle of those two lands it has the world, which does tend to make you think that it's talking about the world. Well, whichever way you go, whether Israel was writhing in pain because they didn't beat their enemies, or if it means that Israel was writhing in pain because they weren't reproducing themselves in the land of Israel after the Babylonian captivity, either way, Israel's in trouble and they're crying out to God in their distress. Now, Isaiah says in verse 18 that Israel gave birth to wind. Now, of course, that sounds like a nice metaphor, no problem, but Adam Clark, who of course is a polymath and knows everything, especially medical stuff back in the 1800s, he says this actually happened with pregnant women. He says it has a medical name, M-pneumatosis. Now, well, who knows whether he's right? This is 19th century medicine, but it's interesting. He says this M-pneumatosis, or windy inflation of the womb, is a disorder to which females are liable. Some have had this in such wise for a long time together that they have appeared to themselves and even to very skillful medical men to be pregnant, and after having endured much pain and even the throes of apparent childbearing, they have been eased and restored to health by the emission of a great quantity of wind from the uterus. This disorder is well known to medical men. Well, I've never heard of it. We go now to Isaiah 26, verses 19 through 21, and we will finish this chapter. Isaiah continues, "But your dead will live, their bodies will rise. You who dwell in the dust, wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. Go, my people, enter your rooms and shut the doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while until his wrath has passed by. See, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. The earth will disclose the blood shed upon her. She will conceal her slain no longer." Now we have talk of a resurrection here in verse 19. Your dead will live, their bodies will rise. The earth will give birth to her dead. That's resurrection, okay? Now Albert Barnes says this, quote, "Very various interpretations have been given of this verse." Well, before we start looking at the options as to what Isaiah meant, let's go back to verse 14 and notice that something very similar was said in that verse. "The dead do not live. Departed spirits do not rise up. Indeed, you have visited and destroyed them. You have wiped out all memory of them." Barnes says that refers to the Babylonians getting wiped out by the Persians. So the bad guys don't have a resurrection and the good guys do have a resurrection. But now the question is what kind of a resurrection are we talking about? Here's option number one, a national resurrection. This is held to by Barnes and Poole. The Jews will be restored to their land after the Babylonian exile. And so there's a national resurrection of the Jews. As Barnes puts it, the Jews were civilly dead in Babylon. Now Barnes uses Isaiah 26:14, that verse I just read to you, to back that up, where Isaiah says the dead do not live, talking about Babylon. They've been destroyed. They've been wiped out. Departed spirits do not rise up. That sounds like a physical wiping out of Babylon. And so if you put that in parallel with verse 19, it sounds like a figurative resurrection of Israel. Now, I'm going to give you two long quotes from two different commentators to back up that idea. Here's the first quote from Benson, quote, "Nothing is more frequent, both in Scripture and other authors, than for great calamities to be compared to death," that would be verse 14, death of the Babylonians, "and deliverance from them to reviving," that would be verse 19. "A resurrection in life, and particularly the captivity of the Jews in Babylon and their deliverance out of it, is largely expressed by this very similitude in Ezekiel 37:11. Let me quote for you Ezekiel 37:11. "Then he said to me, Son of man," that's Ezekiel, son of man, "these bones are the whole house of Israel. They have been saying our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, and we are cut off." And of course, you know about the story of the resurrection of the bones, the dry bones. So there you have a resurrection as symbolic of the house of Israel, ultimately fulfilled in the church, the new Israel. Well, here's what Adam Clark says about this. Quote, "The deliverance of the people of God from a state of the lowest depression is explained by images plainly taken from the resurrection of the dead. In the same manner, the prophet Ezekiel represents the restoration of the Jewish nation from a state of utter dissolution by the restoring of the dry bones to life, exhibited to him in a vision, which is directly thus applied and explained. And this deliverance is expressed with a manifest opposition to what is here said above," verse 14, of the great lords and tyrants under whom they had groaned. They are dead. They shall not live. They are deceased tyrants. They shall not rise. In other words, the Babylonian nation is going to stay in the grave, and the nation of Israel is going to rise from the grave, and resurrection is figurative. The tyrants should be destroyed utterly and should never be restored to their former power and glory. It appears from hence that the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead was at that time a popular and common doctrine, for an image which is assumed in order to express or represent anything in the way of allegory or metaphor, whether poetical or prophetical, must be an image commonly known and understood. Otherwise, it will not answer the purpose for which it is assumed. All right, here's a little rabbit trail here. If Isaiah is talking about the resurrection of Israel, and if he's using a commonly known metaphor of physical resurrection, then that means the people must believe in it, which gives some evidence that the people in the Old Testament believed in the resurrection of the dead. Now let's look at some other options as to which resurrection verse 19 is referring to. John Gill says it's the first resurrection, which is people getting born again in the church age. Typically, in my opinion, that might be true. I don't think that's what Isaiah was primarily referring to. I should say anti-typically, he could refer to the first resurrection. The pulpit commentary says this resurrection is the second physical resurrection at the end of the world. Barnes denies that. Colin Delitzsch says it's the church will figuratively rise, not the nation of Israel, but the new Israel, the church, will figuratively rise from the dead. A gentleman named Kimchi, whom I read somewhere, says that Isaiah is referring to the Matthew 27 resurrections at the time of Jesus. You recall when Jesus was raised again, there were resurrections in the city of Jerusalem. I think that's a stretch. I prefer to take it very simply that Isaiah was referring to the resurrection of the nation of Israel, and typologically to the resurrection of the church. In verse 20, Isaiah says the earth will give birth to her dead. That's just another fancy way of saying the dead are going to rise from the grave. And then in verse 20, Isaiah says, "Go, my people, enter your rooms and shut the doors behind you. Hide yourselves until his wrath has passed by." What rooms are they supposed to go to? Option number one, this is an allusion to persons abroad in the fields. They're supposed to go back indoors. As John Gill says, quote, "Who, when they perceive a storm coming, make haste home and get into their houses and into the more retired and safer parts of them till it is over." In other words, go to your rooms for safety. That's option number one. Option number two, Isaiah is making an allusion to the Israelites at the Passover who kept within their doors while the destroying angel passed through the land of Egypt. So Isaiah would be saying, just like the Israelites hid from the destroying angel, you need to do the same thing. Now who the they is my people. So if it's an allusion to the Passover, the people of Israel would be protected until the wrath of God had passed over the lintel of the door, and you would assume that Israel would be the subject of God's wrath, which would be turned away. I think that's a little bit strained. Third option, which rooms the Israelites would go to. The third option is that this is an allusion to Rahab and her family being within her house when Jericho was destroyed. You recall the story. The Israelites said, "Rahab, if you'll stay in your house, we won't destroy you when we destroy the wall as we destroyed Jericho." The wrath would be the wrath of the Israelite armies passing by. Or option number four, the rooms that God's people go into could be places of prayer and devotion while the wrath and judgment is going on. Well, closely related to the question of which rooms the Israelites are going into is the question of which wrath is passing by. Here's some options on that. Wrath falling on the earth during the so-called Great Tribulation. That's the dispensationalist Guzik's view, and I discount that very quickly. It could be the Assyrians falling on northern Israel. Gary Smith and Ellicott suggest that. It could be the Babylonians. Barnes and Ellicott suggest that, and that's who I think it is. Could be the whole world, as Clark and Benson and Poole suggest. Or it could be wrath falling on Israel if we take earth as land here. Let me read it that way. In verse 21, "See, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the land for their sins." Well, if that's the case, then it would make sense to go into one's room and pray until the wrath over the land passed. But I still think it's talking about judgment on the Babylonians. So go in there and pray. And then when you pray, God will get rid of the Babylonians, and his wrath on the Babylonians will be executed, and then it will pass away because it's finished, it's over, and you'll be free. And so once again, the wrath could either be on one of the nations of the world, the Israelites are supposed to wait until that wrath is executed so they're safe, or it could be wrath on Israel itself until God has expiated his wrath, which has fallen on the land and not the earth. I take it to be the people of the earth. I think most translations probably put earth there instead of land. That's Haaretz, which can be translated either way. And I think that we need to end this chapter on a positive note, because most everything that Isaiah says is positive, and I don't see him going right back to talking about how Israel's going to be punished for their sins, right, when in the middle of his excoriations of the nations of the world. Although, if you go back a few verses, Israel is compared to a woman about to give birth to a child and instead gives birth to wind, and the Israelites writhed in pain and so forth. Negative stuff. So it could be either one. I report, you decide. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 26. We are prepared now to go to Isaiah chapter 27, which I will call the redemption of Israel. That's some good news. It seems one common theme of Old Testament law, prophecy, writings, is judgment comes first and redemption comes second. You don't have one without the other. So we'll see in our next chapter if that's so. I hope you stay tuned for that chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.